Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and thank you for joining us. We're now well into an era that's dominated by digital screens and short video reels, but there's no way around it. Reading is still a foundation of the intellectual and emotional development of our kids. And it's not just an educational tool. Reading is a gateway to the world, to ideas and possibilities. In recent years, that gateway seemed to be narrowing. And recognition that this was happening was the driver behind the state legislature's passage of the Read to Succeed Act of 2022. Now that a couple of years have gone by, education contributor Bridget Blom wanted to find out whether and how the act has made a difference.
In 2015, 40% of Kentucky fourth graders were reading proficiently. By 2022, that number had dropped to 31%. Dragging the state's ranking from 8th in the nation to 29th. This decline isn't just due to the pandemic. Earlier indicators in key educational benchmarks were evident even before our schools and families had to grapple with that reality. The Act equips the Kentucky Department of Education with tools to offer additional instruction for teachers and administrators and sets a timeline for implementing reading screeners for K-3 students to provide early support measures if needed. Today, we're speaking with Mickey Ray, the Chief Academic Officer at the Kentucky Department of Education. With her extensive experience in education and literacy, Mickey has been instrumental in supporting schools and districts to achieve highly effective teaching and learning for students and to achieve greater proficiency in reading. Mickey, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be with you today to talk about this important work.
Mickey, can you start by explaining the key objectives of the Read to Succeed Act and its importance in the context of Kentucky's educational goals?
Absolutely. So I think at the heart of this legislation is the student. And that is so critical for us as we move forward, because just as you mentioned, we are not satisfied. And I don't think that there's any educator who is satisfied with our outcomes in literacy across the Commonwealth. And so the goal of the legislation is to ensure that there is critical importance placed on reading proficiency by grade three, and that students have access to grade level learning that is aligned to evidence-based practices, but also our Kentucky academic standards, in a way that will allow them to both decode text, but also be able to comprehend rich and meaningful text that is at their grade level.
So there's been something of a debate nationally in reading for a number of years, and that debate in part led to the Read to Succeed Act in Kentucky. Recently, you hosted a statewide conference where I believe 1,500 educators from across the state attended, and that conference included Emily Hanford, who broke, if you will, the story around reading. Give us just a snapshot of kind of what's taken place in recent years nationally around how educators and policymakers think about reading and what's important in teaching reading to success.
So I think one of the most important points that she made in her keynote is that a lot of our notions and ideas around the teaching of reading was grounded in a methodology that was enacted well before the National Reading Panel. And so educators today have greater access to the evidence basis for how the brain learns to read, why some students are struggling. And, you know, it's part of our responsibility as educators to make that research accessible and impactful to the student learning experience. And so, you know, when we think about moving from what was whole language or balanced literacy to structured literacy, the point and intention of that is that all students are benefited by access to structured literacy practices, but there are some students who will not learn to decode language, who will not learn to read and access text without the support of structured literacy practices, where they are engaging with not only letters and sounds, but the phonics that is critical. And that, paired with knowledge building in a tier one high quality instructional resource, course, is the foundation that students need to be able to both decode and comprehend. And all of that, you know, we talk about educational research and education, we're slow to change to the research. And they usually say it's about 10 years for us to see evidence of the evidence basis. And, you know, it's been 24 years since the National Reading Panel. And so Kentucky is not alone in being sort of slow to embrace that change around reading practice, but I am so encouraged by the momentum that we're seeing in our state around a desire to know that evidence basis and then to act upon it for the good of the student experience. Yeah,
that's great. And it took some courage for legislators and policymakers like yourself to embrace that topic because it really became heated across the state. I've kind of unpacked the reading issue to see it from two big components. One, I refer to it as technical reading. So the phonics, the letter and word recognition, and then there's this whole issue of comprehension. And when we think about reading, it's not just the technical, can I read the words on the paper? It's also about comprehension. Am I really understanding what I'm reading, and can I process that and get it back out to show understanding? How are teachers being better prepared to teach the technical aspects of reading so that all young people can read words on a piece of paper and can then comprehend at higher levels to further their learning throughout their lifelong education?
Everything that we're doing is in direct alignment with what you just shared. I think that some of the original criticism of the quote unquote science of reading movement was that it only focused on phonemic awareness and phonics. And that is certainly not the case. You know, we have been given the opportunity because of the Read to Succeed Act to start what we have coined the Kentucky Reading Academies. And the language essentials for teachers of reading and spelling, so the letters training, has been the first professional learning offering that is a part of the reading academies. And it shows the significance of just what you're speaking to. So in year one, there is extensive information on the brain science, and it focuses on phonemic awareness and phonics in year one. But in year two, it does move on to vocabulary, to fluency, to comprehension, the reading and writing connection. So if we only have students who are able to decode the words on the page, but not fully be able to make meaning from the text, then we've still missed the mark. But we also can't just expect students to be able to comprehend and have a joy for reading and engage in text if they cannot truly decode the words on the page. So it is never an or situation. This is about the significance of all of that learning and really finding a way to equip and empower teachers to be able to identify the specific diverse reading needs of their own students and then be able to equip and empower that student to be able to engage with grade level text.
And there are some serious issues that maybe we don't talk enough about as a state when it comes to the technical reading aspects. So dyslexia comes to mind. What teachers are learning now through the Kentucky Reading Academies would equip them to better differentiate for individual youngsters what their needs are and maybe any challenges that present, like dyslexia, so that we are responding to those challenges and nonetheless helping ensure that that youngster is able to read and then move on to comprehending what they read.
Absolutely. And we still have much learning. I will be completely transparent in that space. And I'm very excited and hopeful. You know, we were just able to announce a new partner in the Statewide Reading Research Center that will be housed at the University of Louisville. And I mean, part of the research agenda for them is to help us to better understand how we can have better diagnosis of the characteristics of dyslexia. We have on the KDE website a toolkit for educators around dyslexia and those characteristics, but it's not enough. And we need further support in being able to support educators in early identification so that those needs can be met sooner for the success of the student as they progress in K-12.
Mickey, there's also a family engagement component to the Read to Succeed Act. So share more with us what that piece is and what you might want families, caregivers to understand about reading as they're watching their youngsters come home and have questions or should have questions about the skills that their young person are gaining.
So that family and community engagement, I think, is one of the most critical components of the Read to Succeed Act. And, you know, when we think about where there are touch points for parents and families, once students are identified by the universal screener and the diagnostic assessment as not meeting benchmark and not progressing toward proficiency in the way that is needed for that grade level, they are given a reading improvement plan. And parents and families are critical stakeholders in that process. They are a part of that team. And we have developed in partnership with other external partners and just within internal KDE staffing resources for parents and families. So there's one for school leaders on two-way communication and the best way to engage with parents and families around those literacy needs. But we also have developed a read at home plan. And so, you know, we know that even just 20 minutes a day of reading at home, of having conversations, text-based questions about reading is wonderful empowerment for students as they engage with the Kentucky academic standards in a school-based setting. But the Read at Home plan has just easy things that parents and families can do at home that don't require a lot of work in terms of, you know, having to cut up or glue things together or make something. It's conversation starters, it's questions, but it should be tailored to the needs of that particular student. And so one of the sessions at the conference that you mentioned, it was packed to capacity and it was offered twice specifically around that Read at Home plan. So I think educators are very interested in how they can engage parents and families more in this space. And we know we want to continue building resources to support those conversations.
Mickey, give us a few bright spots in the couple remaining minutes that we have left. We're maybe about 2 years out from an implementation standpoint. What bright spots are you beginning to see that are giving you hope?
So in terms of the statewide professional learning, you know, the letters professional learning, we have had overwhelmingly positive feedback about that. The teachers and the administrators are saying that, number one, this is new learning. But secondly, it is relevant and immediately applicable to meeting the diverse needs of the students in their classrooms. And so that has been immensely encouraging. And, you know, we have currently over 4,000 educators who are participating in the letters training. We are opening up a third cohort, and that registration will close in August. So if there are any listeners on the call, there is still time to sign up for that. But we also are seeing increased adoption rates. So we have a voluntary survey that we do around the adoption of high quality instructional resources. And as part of the legislation, superintendents were asked to make that selection in consultation with educators, community members, families, students, and other stakeholders. And based on our last year's survey, so 23-24, over 90% of the new adoptions in the literacy space are, in fact, high quality resources. So we're very encouraged by that. And just one other quick point I want to make about that. So we had a third party evaluation by ICF of our letters professional learning. And that was very important to us because we want to be good stewards of the funding and we want to show that there is an impact on the actual student experience from all of this work. And they found that obviously the teachers who were in the second year of the letters training were more likely to be able to skillfully apply the learning and the strategies as part of their curriculum. But even more important, those who had district leaders and principals who were invested in the process were able to more easily make those changes in terms of evidence-based practices as a part of their instruction. And so that makes great sense. But the survey also found that fourth and fifth graders who have access to high-quality instructional resources outperform students in like similar groups that did not have access to HQIR. So I am very encouraged just by the organic movement that's happening for teachers and leaders to participate in the statewide professional learning, but also that we are already starting to see an impact on the student experience based upon their access to high quality resources and evidence-based literacy instruction.
This is a wonderful testament to, I think, our ability as a state to really focus in on the research and the evidence base, to follow the data, to commit to returning to a place of progress and improving our outcomes as a state and our rankings as a state, and following through on that commitment. So, Mickey Ray with the Kentucky Department of Education, thank you so much for joining us on Eastern Standard. We look forward to following this story in the years to come.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
A symposium on the horrors of a century of racial violence in Kentucky and the repercussions that linger today is happening at the Lyric Theater in Lexington on Saturday, November 9th. If you're listening to us on Sunday evening and hearing about this for the first time, there's a website you can visit. We've posted a link on our homepage at esweku.org. Here to tell us about this event and what inspires it is Nikki Brown, Associate Professor of History, African American and Africana Studies at the University of Kentucky. Welcome, Dr. Brown.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Tell us what will be explored at the Racial Violence in Kentucky Symposium.
Thank you for giving us an opportunity to talk about this really pressing issue. The symposium was kind of the brainchild of two different groups, one called Documenting Racial Violence in Kentucky. And that was the first entity. And the second entity is the Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Law Clinic at the Rosenberg College of Law. And those two entities kind of focus on the same thing, but are separated by just a few decades. The DRVK looks at lynchings in Kentucky between 1880 to 1950 and the number of people who were lynched. And the Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Law Clinic looks at lynchings between the 1950s and 60s and tries to connect descendants of people who were lynched with the history of the lynching in order to affect some type of change to, and perhaps provide accountability as well. So those two teams kind of met and we said it would be really great to have a symposium on racial violence in Kentucky, because as my esteemed colleague George Wright wrote, Kentucky, for at least a century, has created an ethos or a myth about itself that it practiced kinder, gentler slavery, and that Reconstruction really was no problem in Kentucky, when in reality, there was a great deal of racial violence that came during slavery, during Reconstruction, and afterwards. So what we wanted the symposium to do is to do three things. Look at racial violence in the past, consider it in the present, and think about ways to have restorative justice in the future.
Well, that's such an important connection to make, the past and the present and the future, because there are those who argue out there that, well, that was then, this is now. However, what happened then certainly lingers now. It's a highly sensitive, emotional subject that intersects with justice and equal rights. And I just wonder, what is your response to that argument?
I have heard that argument. That argument is quite popular. And my response really is to ask the person to take a step back and think about their knee-jerk reaction. Why is the knee-jerk reaction to push it away and say, we don't have to deal with that anymore? Because that's actually the opposite. If you don't care about something, or rather, if you're thinking about something that's painful in the past, but you have resolved it and you've come to a place of restorative justice about it, then there's no problem talking about it. But it's a sign that you haven't dealt with the past trauma if somebody brings it up and says, no, I don't want to deal with that. I'm just going to push it away, because it doesn't have anything to do with me right now. That would be an indication of what mental health professionals would call trying to bury trauma, trying to repress trauma. And of course, we know pushing things down and keeping things in is not a good way at all to resolve those things.
You know, it may even be traumatic, if I may use that strong term, for white descendants of slaveholders now to realize that their ancestors were engaged in this and that that bloodline has been passed down to them.
Yes, yes. But so it's also a way to make amends. And one of the things that we really try to stress, those historians who focus on racial violence and restorative justice, is that these types of historical traumas, racial traumas, unfortunately, they are not unusual. And to answer your previous question and this one, honestly, just talk about the history of the Holocaust and restorative justice. So to go back to your previous question, you know, if someone were to say, oh, I don't want to talk about that, that's bad stuff. We would kind of ask that person, what is it about talking about the Holocaust that gets you so defensive? Because in reality, Germany has done a very good job about acknowledging what has happened, acknowledging the people who played the role in it, and in remembering it. And this endeavor, this racial violence symposium, is a step in that direction to acknowledge that something terrible has happened in our past and work towards restoring it. And one of the ways you can work towards restoring it is to not just acknowledge it, but work on concrete programs for people to talk about it in the future. That's where our project is really the jump off. Really what we really want to do is begin to open up discussions about racial violence across the state, because I get comments from teachers regularly saying that they want to talk about racial violence, but they just don't know how and they don't know where to start. Mm-hmm. So this endeavor is part of that process.
Well, again, this symposium's happening at the Lyric Theater in Lexington on November the 9th. That's this coming Saturday. And again, if you're listening to us on Sunday evening, that was yesterday, but you can find out more about it online at the website that I mentioned. Nikki, who is welcome at the symposium?
Oh, we really want to have people from the community of Lexington, people who aren't just sort of community organizers or people who are educators. Those folks are very, very much welcome. We want to have people who are interested in talking about the history of slavery and Jim Crow in Lexington. And we also want people who are genealogists. We want people who really have a long and deep connection in Lexington and want to really talk about things or want to really openly discuss what does restorative justice look like. To speak directly to your question, people who want to hear George Wright, who is the intellectual sort of father of this project, if they want to hear this esteemed professor and former university president talk about the process in 1990 of researching and writing about racial violence using microfilm and microfilm readers and using physical newspapers, then they should come out on Saturday, November 9th to hear him speak. He's going to be speaking, I think, in the morning at 9 a.m. So people who are interested in history, interested in Lexington history, African-American history, and Kentucky history, everyone is welcome.
So do you need to pre-register or can you just show up?
It's best that you pre-register so that we can get a sense of how many people are there, because lunch or snacks will be provided throughout the event. You can go to the website. Because the event is hosted by the Commonwealth Institute of Black Studies at the University of Kentucky, please go to cibs.as.uky.edu. You go to that website, you click on the events, it's right there, and it will take you straight to the registration page.
All right, that's Dr. Nikki Brown, Associate Professor of History, African American and Africana Studies at the University of Kentucky. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure and honor to speak with you.
Coming up after the break, when the weather turns violent, what about the arts? Part one in a two-part interview with Lexington's Arts and Culture Director. And what is it about flamenco music?
The passion.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events from Kentucky Humanities. On Saturday, November 9th, the Garrett County Public Library in Lancaster will host Kentucky Reads, Scissors, Paper, Rock. The discussion will begin at 5 p.m. On Tuesday, November 12th, the Kenton County Public Library in Covington will host Speakers Bureau, Rascals, Heroes, and Just Plain Uncommon Folks from Kentucky, presented by James Claypool. The program will begin at 1:30 p.m. And on Thursday, November 14th, the Capital Activity Center in Frankfort will host Kentucky Chautauqua, Adolph Rupp, the Coach. This show will begin at 10:30 a.m. For more information on programs and coming events, visit kyhumanities.org. I'm Sherry Lawson. Now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
What is lost in the violence and the power of tornadoes and floods? Lives, for sure. Homes, schools, and businesses, too. But also the art that tells the stories of places and people. Those losses, and organizing to be ready for whatever nature has in store for us in the future, are documented and detailed in Kentucky Arts in Disaster, an Impact Report. With us here in the studio is the report's author, Leah Hamilton, Assistant Professor of Arts Administration at the University of Kentucky. And we thank you, Leah, for taking time to talk with us about the findings that are contained in this report.
Thanks for having me today.
It seems all the more vital at a time when it's clear that severe, even extreme weather events are becoming more frequent in our world. Was that a motivation to do this work?
Certainly. I think there were some compounding events in Kentucky, as I know you covered so well. But particularly between 2020 and 2022, there were 7 federally declared disasters in the state. And, of course, 2 of those were well covered in the media and had widespread damage. And those were compounded by the pandemic. And I think these factors led to those in arts communities reaching out to the Kentucky Arts Council in particular, requesting the need for assistance and resources. And, you know, having these 2 specific disasters in Western Kentucky with the tornadoes and then Eastern Kentucky with the flooding within 7 months of each other, mm-hmm. it really heightened an awareness for those state agents working at the Arts Council and also at the Humanities Council that, wow, we need to focus on how we can do better in the future, because I think it caught everyone off guard in the arts community and and in the cultural heritage community.
For sure,
too.
And stretched resources very thin and
exactly.
so forth.
Yeah.
A lot of people were involved in gathering data and making observations for this report. And you note in the report that every effort was made to use present, current, and correct information as of April of 2024. And I wondered if you could just tell us briefly a little bit more about that. I think it helps the listener recognize the strength of these findings.
So there are 2 viewpoints on this. One is, as a researcher, I approach everything with this belief that I don't want, especially with disaster situations, to be this objective, rational observer. I really believe in letting the stories of those directly involved come to light. And it's sort of my, I guess you could say I come from a very humble place of just wanting to bring those stories to light. Also, this particular report was aimed at policymakers and funders to say, here are some ways that we can do better for our arts communities in terms of disaster relief and recovery. So I wanted to make sure that those that reading the report know that policies are changing every day. As you know, the political climate and its coverage means that things are changing. And even since the report came out, or when I stopped writing the report in April of 2024, there have been some policy changes that have occurred since then. So I wanted the readers to know that these are the stories of real Kentucky artists, craftspeople, educators, that I just had the honor of compiling their stories, and also that a lot is changing all the time. So we'll just keep a pulse on it. But those policies that I directly address in here, some we're seeing some positive change already.
Okay, let's dig into it just a little bit and jump to page 18, the summary of findings. And first, maybe look at areas of losses, because that gives us a good sense of how devastating these events can be for working artists. In our coverage area, Apple Shop in Whitesburg is an example of the devastation that was brought by the flood of 22. What can you tell us about what they experienced?
Apple Shop was and still is a cultural icon. And mm-hmm. I think what was highlighted in this disaster is the history and how much we value the history of our regions and what this captures about our history and our culture. You know, with Apple Shop, for its first floor to be 8 feet underwater and to have a majority of its archives damaged, I think it hits to our soul. And it's not something that just happens to maybe smaller groups to have to suffer like this, that it can also affect our larger institutions too. So in the instance of Apple Shop, they are so nationally known, they had resources. I mean, the federal agencies that came to help, FEMA's partnership with Smithsonian, they sent individuals with specialized knowledge on how to preserve and salvage film reels and other books and items in their archives. And they worked to train the trainer, working with their archival staff. So I think in a way, despite the devastation, they can also serve as a model of how being socially connected to local roots, but also state and national agencies can really help an organization recover more quickly.
Of course, there's been a lot of reporting around what happened to Apple Shop, but you touched on smaller groups there, and you do cite a bunch of examples, and I'd like to dig into one of them here, the community theater group in Boonville. What happened to them?
This was a story that hit me deeply. I grew up in the Missouri Ozarks and was really involved in community theater growing up, and when I did the interview with the community theater group in Boonville, Kentucky, they talked about the series of original plays that they had been building over time, and the community looked forward to these plays because the characters were recurring. The one that they were working on right before the Eastern Kentucky flooding was called Inconvenient Dreams, and they said it had volunteer actors from the ages of 9 to 70 years old, so a real diverse pool of the community people involved, but also individuals that look forward to going and experiencing this new play that was about to premiere. Then the flooding hit, and it directly affected the lives of those in the production, losing family members as well as audiences, people that would have come to see the show. So they decided to cancel the show, and it still has not been put on since. And the managerial aspect of this is, and this is something I highlight in the report, is that it's difficult to navigate this want to provide recovery through arts and culture in a community, but also being sensitive to those who have been directly affected by the disaster. And then there's the logistical side of, you know, the work that they were doing was to raise money for this facility that they've been renovating in downtown Boonville. So not having the ticket sales meant that they were stalled for more than a year. And then that, of course, has the impact of the loss of actual income and projected income, which in the report highlights that that is the biggest sense of loss, not only from individual artists, but also arts managers that are working in arts organizations, that the actual income loss, but also projected income loss, was the biggest area of loss for the arts sector, in addition to physical structure and equipment damage.
A lot of data was gathered, a lot of statistics for this report. And so let's zoom out and look at the big picture and those numbers and what they can tell us about the impact on the arts of these disasters.
A big takeaway, I think we could start with financial. It's a majority of arts organizations are small businesses. Individual artists, studios are small businesses. And the impact of disasters on small businesses means that they can close their doors because of just one significant disaster event and its impact on them financially. What I also wanted to show in this report was outside of money and those numbers, but to also look at the heart and soul of this, which looked at the mental health impact and the trauma, also the resiliency of the arts community, that these arts workers in their communities in many ways became social workers and provided their spaces for actors who lost their home to stay, or those who needed food or shelter, that they opened their facilities to them. So I wanted, outside of just numbers, to also highlight the role that arts and culture plays in community recovery, too, in response.
What did you learn about federal disaster assistance when it applies to the arts?
From an arts perspective, under 1%, 0.8% of those applicants that were deemed eligible for FEMA assistance were arts and culture. So I'll just let that soak in for a minute. Under 1%. Now, that doesn't account for some arts and cultural organizations that might be part of a city's application for federal assistance. I know that some museums may have partnered with their city. And so I think that's telling. And what the report uncovered in interviews is that it was multifaceted. Some people didn't even want to try because it was so complicated. Then there were issues with having to apply for a small business loan first. And then once you're denied that, you can go and apply for FEMA. But I think even deeper than that is just the deadlines. And then you go deeper than that, that tools that we use as artists are not covered. Before April of 2024, you know, guitars, kilns, things like this by some caseworkers were not deemed equipment that would be covered by federal disaster assistance. Now, I will say this is changing because my report is not the only one to uncover this issue with artists and arts organizations. And FEMA has since, just in the past few months, is adjusting and has opened for public comment these new policies that would include artistic tools and equipment to be covered.
Do these experiences with the tornadoes in the west and the floods in the east here point to a need for better emergency response and recovery on the state and the local levels?
I love this question because any disaster response can be better. We can always build and learn. And I think that's maybe the most inspiring part of the trauma behind a disaster event is we can learn from it. And I heard that from so many respondents and interviewees that they wanted their stories to be told so that others can learn from their experiences. But we have two different sectors. We have the emergency management sector, and then we have the arts and culture sector. And our languages are so different. The way we function is so different. And we need to connect and build relationships between the two sectors in order for there to be better response. So I think that puts a responsibility not just on FEMA, because it, in a way, it's kind of an easy way to say, oh, federal assistance needs change. But also, I think it's empowering to think how those in the arts community can get to know their local emergency manager before an emergency or disaster occurs. So I think we can, in the arts sector, try to build relationships and build a stronger bridge. And I think the same goes in the emergency management community. How can they understand the work that we do in the arts? Because as you said, it's very specialized. I heard from a lot of artists and arts managers that they would get upset because when the private companies or disaster agents would come in, they didn't understand that the work that they were doing in those studios had rare wood. Don't throw away that rare wood. That I need that to build a dulcimer and they just saw it as a piece of wood. But those that have specialized knowledge in the work of artists and the work of those in museum work, you could say, in preservation, if we can build that body of knowledge in our sector and mm-hmm. help train our emergency managers and those in the private sector that do restoration work, I think that's the key to better response. I also would like to highlight the work that has happened since the tornado and the flooding, and it sort of was born out of these disasters. And that is an initiative lovingly called KHERN, K-H-E-R-N, the Kentucky Heritage Emergency Response Network. And this is dedicated individuals throughout the state that have specialized knowledge in arts and culture and that want to connect people on the ground to resources more quickly when the next disaster occurs or emergency occurs specifically in any area. So I think this initiative will help cut down some of that frustration that was discovered in this report of how to navigate working with federal agencies, understanding what funding opportunities there are, and navigating again that convergence of it's overwhelming in the beginning of a disaster of all of these agencies that want to provide support but don't exactly know how. Mm-hmm. And Kern can be that middle agency to help connect those on the ground to resources at the state and federal level.
All right. That's Leah Hamilton, Assistant Professor of Arts Administration at the University of Kentucky. And we thank you so much for this really important work and for especially sharing it with us.
I appreciate you giving it time and awareness. Thank you.
We're beginning a new recurring interview feature on the arts in our region in partnership with the online arts magazine Undermain. Art Check It will be hosting the series and gets going with a two-part interview with Lexington Arts and Culture Director Heather Lyons.
Welcome, Heather Lyons, to Eastern Standard.
Thank you so much.
We're glad to have you here. You're the Director of Arts and Cultural Affairs for the Lexington Fayette Urban County Government. Tell our listeners what that job entails.
Well, honestly, it's evolved quite a bit. I've been there now 5.5 years. And when I first began, I worked primarily with local organizations and with city agencies in planning fairs and festivals and events that they wanted to have on city property. And so all of that is ongoing work. But I've also had the opportunity now as I was starting with the city had just passed a percent for art resolution. And so the next step to be able to activate that percent for art fund was to create a public art commission, create a public art master plan, and then begin enacting that plan. So that has been a large part of my work over these past several years. In addition, one of my own priorities is to really look for opportunities for the city to support and engage artists and arts organizations in new ways that they haven't in the past. And so, for instance, a new program that I established is called Art on the Town, and that provides free art carts for artists to utilize to sell their work. And I'm really delighted with the way that program has grown. We have about 65 artists now engaged, and that's evolved into further professional development workshops for artists that have kind of sprung out of that program. And then I'm involved in a number of different commissions, the Picnic with the Pops Commission, Sister Cities Commission, of course, the Public Art Commission, and also the newer 250 Lex Commission, preparing for the celebration of our city's anniversary. And then many other things. There's growing film production going on in Lexington, so I'm working with Visit Lex on new guidelines for that. And it's just really a constantly changing and evolving to support whatever needs are coming up.
Sounds like a really full portfolio of activities and responsibilities. You mentioned Art on the Town. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about where people can find these art carts, how they encounter them.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have partnered with a couple of organizations, Farmers Market and also Thursday Night Live. So those are weekly events where the art carts and artists can participate. We also set up our own monthly event called Art on the Town in Tandy Park, and that occurs on the third Fridays of every month between April and September. And so that is an opportunity where we can take over all of Tandy Park and not only support the visual artists and craftspeople and also authors who are utilizing those carts, but we're also hiring musicians that perform at each of those events as well. And then they're also out and about at every city downtown festival, you know, 4th of July, Thriller Parade, the Roots and Heritage Festival. So we're trying to provide as many opportunities as possible for them to get the carts out.
Coming out of the lockdown years of the pandemic, there were lots of concerns about the impact of those difficult years on Lexington's arts and culture scene. What's your assessment of how arts and culture emerged from those years?
That's a great question. I think we are still seeing a really significant and difficult impact on our arts organizations and artists. Those years when our arts facilities had to close their doors and weren't able to generate revenue, artists weren't able to exhibit their work, it's had a lasting impact. And some of those organizations have not yet been able to get back up to the staffing levels they had had before. People have been slow to return to ticket purchasing. We've seen, you know, just differences in the way that people are seeking out events. I feel like this spring and summer, we're starting to get a little more out of that. But it wasn't immediate for sure. And, you know, absolutely the organizations are all looking for additional support, you know, especially for operating needs.
What can the everyday citizen do to help with that?
Oh, well, support them in every way by attending their events. Of course, you can always make direct donations to those organizations that you feel are really doing the work that you're interested in. But, you know, buy a ticket for a friend, attend their events, share those events with your friends. You know, social media has a lot of direct impact and opportunities to let people know about events, and it costs you nothing to share or like an event that someone is trying to promote. And, you know, I think it's also important to contact your city council members and let them know that if there are particular organizations or artists or work that you see being done in the community, that they're aware of it. Because all of that, it's so important for the city to know and be aware of how they can support artists and organizations.
Taking the big picture view of things, what do you see as the strengths of Lexington's arts and culture scene right now?
Well, we have a tremendous community of artists. You know, I have long felt that individual artists are really the backbone of everything that happens. You know, our arts organizations depend on those individual artists. You know, the Philharmonic, every one of those musicians is an individual artist as well, that's not only involved in the Philharmonic, but is teaching lessons. They're working in other kinds of music combos. Visual artists, of course, are working within organizations, but also creating their own individual work. So I think it's really critical first that we make sure that we're supporting artists, we're enabling them to stay in Lexington, and creating as many opportunities as possible for them to do their work and to remain here.
And are there any specific areas of weakness that stand out to you that you think we can strengthen over the next few years?
Well, I would like to see a greater, more robust way that the city and other agencies can support artists and organizations through funding. I think there's just no getting around that funding's critical. You know, organizations cannot operate without the money. They can't have new programs unless they have staff support to create those programs. For those organizations that have facilities, they need operating support to maintain those facilities. And so, you know, I think it is important, and I think there are opportunities to perhaps look at some other cities, other communities who have looked at some new ways of providing funding or of managing those funds that perhaps Lexington could consider.
Such as?
Well, such as a variety of cities that have departments for the arts and funding opportunities within their city government. Certainly, that is a model that I believe more cities are involved in. Of course, you know, anything we can do to just increase the level. Since I've been with the city, I have participated with a couple of partnerships in bringing in National Endowment for the Arts grants. We had civic artists involved working with Civic Lex, which was a really wonderful program, very new for the city. And so, you know, those are kinds of things that I think I'd like to see us continue to do and to do with additional partners in the community.
Part two of Art Checkett's conversation with Heather Lyons next week here on Eastern Standard. The mission of Green Room Exchange is to go out into the world, find great music that tells the stories of cultures, and bring it to Lexington. The latest from Barcelona, Spain, the flamenco fusion of Las Migas.
Hoy ha salido el sol y tú no estabas. Quería olerte el pelo en la mañana temprana.
After winning a Latin Grammy Award for Best Flamenco Album in 2022, the all-female quartet is now touring their new album, Rumberas, which has been nominated for another Latin Grammy. According to the liner notes, Rumberas fuses Catalan rumba, flamenco, and other traditional Spanish music styles with influences from Mexico and Cuba, where rumba originated in the 19th century, drawing from African and Spanish forms. Las Migas is performing this music at the Singletary Center on the campus of the University of Kentucky on the evening of Saturday, November 16th. So I put in a call to the band's guitarist and composer, Marta Robles.
If you don't know how to sing flamenco, it's very difficult to do it. You know, it's not like if you are a guitar player and you learn a little bit. I think the singing, you have to study for many years to be a good flamenco singer, because it's a very special way of singing music.
Flamenco is Spanish soul music associated with the country's Andalusia region, which was recently struck by the same kind of flash flooding that hit eastern Kentucky in 2022. Think Appalachian bluegrass, Memphis soul, or Louisiana Cajun or Zydeco. UNESCO recently recognized it as part of the world's intangible cultural heritage, a complex art form that blends poetry, singing, guitar playing, dance, polyrhythmic hand clapping, and finger snapping. If there's one word that best describes the music, says Robles, it's this one.
The passion. There is some strong feelings, strong stories, strong ways of making this music that make it very special and unique. And I think this is why we are lucky to travel all around the world, because we can reach so many hearts, you know, with our music. And this makes me feel so lucky.
And there's something special about this band of women musicians.
I think we were the first flamenco band formed by women.
And now they're bringing flamenco to Lexington.
We are also really looking forward, because it's a city we have never been. We love to explore and to know new places in the world.
The flamenco music of Las Migas, live on the Singletary stage on November 16th. Want to know more? You can get all the details online at greenroomexchange.org. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org. You can check out our archive, our series, our partners, and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. And you can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions available on Apple, Spotify, Buzzsprout, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. And remember, as Yogi Berra put it, if the world were perfect, it wouldn't be. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.